You're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. I'm Jed Bodwin, and my guest on this episode of the show is Bob Lord. Lord is a founding member of the rock band Dreadnought and CEO of Parma Recordings, a company focused on bringing cutting-edge classical works to musically adventurous listeners. Parma has received numerous Grammy nominations and awards since its inception in 2008. Additionally, Lord has composed music for a variety of outlets, including film. He's also served as musical director for the New Hampshire Public Radio The Musical series, Writers on a New England Stage. We discussed his early years playing music in Massachusetts, including his being a founding member of the group that would become Converge, his entry into the classical world, playing bass up close with The Who's John Entwistle, how Dreadnought has stayed together for roughly 30 years, and what makes the music he releases under the Parma umbrella stand out from other releases in the classical sphere. That's Bob Lord on Into Music, coming up now. You came up playing rock music, and was that where music began for you, or were you a kid who had like taken piano lessons and then later got bitten by the rock bug? How did that work?
Well, you know, I guess looking back, I was always very artsy. It was really about visual arts with me when I was in my single digits. I was a comic book collector when I was a little kid. I still am. I still have all the same books. I don't think I've ever sold a comic book or a guitar or a bass or anything. They just keep getting piled on. But, you know, I started to get into music when I heard the Beatles when I was probably 6 or 7. And I heard the early stuff. And then, you know, I got those two tapes, the red tape and the blue tape. And I listened to the red tape, and I liked it. It's All Really Great Love Me Do. And then I put on the blue tape, and I heard I Am the Walrus. And I was like, oh, my God, what the fuck is this? So I started listening to a lot of music at that point, and just started to kind of tinker around. Like, you know, had a keyboard. I tried to pick up some musical instruments, but nothing really took until I heard The Who play. And then I heard Entwistle. I heard Townsend. And I said, that's what I want to do with the rest of my life. And I picked up a bass. So I started playing bass when I was 12. I did my first gig when I was 13. I produced my first record when I was 14, and I did my first tour when I was 15. And from that point on, it was just didn't even look back. And then just, you know, listening to more and more different stuff. Like, naturally, if you're going from the Beatles to whatever, Jerry Lee and Elvis and all the shit, and then you get to The Who, and then it's like, well, what's adjacent? Well, Led Zeppelin. And then you find yourself listening to Rush. Next thing you know, there's like a Gentle Giant record on your on your deck, and then by the time I was like maybe 18, 19, I heard Stravinsky, and you know, like I wasn't in love with Beethoven and Brahms and Mozart. It just didn't hold a lot of appeal for me because I was already listening to shit that I think, you know, harmonically was much more sophisticated than that, if I can say. And it was when I heard Stravinsky and Bartok and Manuel de Falla and then Copland and all those guys, I said, oh, okay, now this is cool. And that's kind of how I got into classical, was just follow my ear. That's about it.
I mean, I have to ask, because Entwistle is like, I can't remember who it was, but somebody I was talking to maybe recently, we were having this conversation, and they're kind of like, well, he's not really a bass player. So that's a pretty heavy influence to pick up early on, and pretty heady inspiration too.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, look, I was listening to Geddy Lee and the Chris Squire, and I think McCartney, you know, he presaged Entwistle in many ways because of just his use of counterpoint and the way he, even though he was a bass player, you know, he really was thinking orchestrally, I believe, in the structure of his bass parts. But yeah, Entwistle wasn't really a bassist, and he himself would say, he's like, I'm a bass guitarist. And Keith Moon wasn't really a drummer per se. He was just a fucking percussionist, a wild percussionist, right? So he had this weird rhythm section that was not in any way a rhythm section, and that it just appealed to me. And when we got the chance to open up for him, I mean, first of all, I could have dropped dead right then and there; it would have been fine. But it was really fun to spend time with him. And I remember after the gig, because we hung out with him before the gig, and he watched the sound check. He was on my side of the stage during our sound check, and he was just watching me. And, you know, he walked over to me and was showing me his rig and gave me his bass and all this shit. And the gig was over. This is 2001. This is when we were recording the American Standard at the time. And And we got invited back on the tour bus after the gig. And so we're hanging out with that whistle on the bus, getting just shit house drunk. And he kind of pulled me back to the back of the bus to where his bedroom was. And he had a practice bass back there, which was like the same pickups that I had in my bass. And he's like, oh, it's the same pickups as yours and blah, blah, blah. He sat down. He's like, show me how you would do this. And so I did. And then I'm like, now you show me how you do that. And we did that for like 20 minutes, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it was so wild to see his technique up close. And I mean, like, you know, a foot away close. my eyes were just right on those fingers the whole time. And it was just very interesting to see how different his technique was from every other quote unquote bass player that I'd ever seen. It was really cool.
And I want to touch on something else too, because you grew up in New Hampshire, right?
I grew up in north of Boston, Andover, Mass, actually.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So, so you weren't like completely isolated from like musical infrastructure and so forth. So putting together a band and launching a tour kind of at a young age wouldn't have necessarily been unheard of in those parts, right?
I wouldn't say it was totally unheard of. It was a little bizarre. When I say tour, it was like, you know, 5 days on the road playing three parties and all the rest, but that was it. I mean, it was like, you know, my parents were bullshit. Like, no, you're not going to go out to New York State and play a bunch of gigs. The weird thing about the town where I grew up is that my class specifically, but the class above us and the class below us as well to a lesser degree, had come out of it a substantial amount of people who are successful in the industry. And I don't mean just like weekend warriors who are playing gigs at the local bar. I mean people like who are doing work on the level that I'm doing it, right? Like Grammys, Billboard number one hits, all the shit. Guy by the name of Ed Jurdy from a group called the Band of Heathens. Ed and I have been playing together since we were 12. I have tapes of him and me doing Queen songs from before our voices changed, right? So we could actually hit the falsetto parts a lot easier. And my buddy Will Daly, also out of my same graduating class, he's been working quite a bit with Eddie Vedder. And then this band called Converge, which I helped to form. I was one of the founding members. That they've gone on to become one of the most important bands in, like, you know, I would just say hardcore metal. Really an unbelievable amount of people. And that's not it. There's like a shitload more. But there was something in the water at that point. And the way that I've described it to a lot of people is that, you know, I had multiple bands when I was in high school and all the time. There's like 4, 5, 6 bands. So the dudes that you were playing in a band with were also your competition. So I think we all learned at a very, very young age that it's not a zero-sum game, that just because my competition succeeds doesn't mean that I lose. And that is a lesson that I think that people don't learn until a lot later in life generally. And I it really was an extraordinary upbringing. Public school, you know, public school system, nothing special. I mean, yeah, Andover's middle upper class, of course, but it was really extraordinary to be involved. And now we're all still in touch, you know, like it's like a network of friends. I mean, I text with Ed and Will, and we see each other all the time. And if there's a problem with the contract, they call me. If there's a problem with an audio master, I call them or whatever. So it's weird how it kind of all began and we all have ended up doing stuff that's, I'd like to think relatively important.
Wow. So did you have like elder musicians in the community who even had like a, you know, they had some way of showing you the ropes or, you know, they'd cut singles and you'd say, okay, we want to be like that band or anything like that?
Nope. There was nothing like that. It was us listening to records as kids and saying, oh, all right, let's try this. Let's try that. So no, there was literally nothing ahead of us that we could have followed. The only person in the entertainment business that any of us knew was Jay Leno. He graduated from our high school. He'd come to, you know, hang out in the cafeteria once a year. That was it. So, I mean, it's really weird when you think about it, like that this whole crew of people who have been really successful in what is probably the hardest industry in the fucking world to succeed in. You know, we didn't have anybody that was like to the manor born. There was nobody whose dad was an exec with, you know, Columbia or whatever. It just didn't happen like that.
Yeah. What was that like then to like the first time that you made money off of playing music? Like you walked away with cash in hand, even if it was $5.
Oh, well, I mean, that was like a revelation, you know. I mean, like selling product and even just getting paid to play a gig. I can remember one gig that we played in high school. I had a band with Ed and Jeff, actually. So like, again, we're all playing in different bands playing together. We were probably, I don't know, 15. And well, we started the band, I think we were 14 or 15, and it was two guitars, bass, drums, keyboards, three female backup singers, four horns. And we were doing all like Motown Stax stuff. And Ed is an incredibly gifted vocalist. If you ever have a chance to listen to him, he's really probably the best singer I've ever worked with in a non-classical setting, right? And so, I mean, he had the blue-eyed soul voice when we were in our mid-teens. I remember playing a gig at the private school in town, Phillips, you know, Phillips Andover. And they hired us to do a gig because our keyboard player was going to school there. And we got paid good money. I mean, I think we got paid, I mean, I don't even know, it was maybe like $1,000 or something like this. Like, I mean, a lot of money. I forget what the exact number was. Yeah, you had to split it up amongst all these people. I think we cut the band down. But to walk out of that gig and to have money and be like, oh, okay, this can work. This is cool, you know? But you know, like around the time that Dreadnought was doing its thing, that's really when we were trying to make it happen was when it became infinitely harder to make it happen. And I think people stopped looking at live music as being a commodity and more as being a nuisance or something to be endured, you know? And now I think you see it even more where, you know, you go to any restaurant where there used to be a jazz trio in the corner, there's Spotify, and it just feels like a completely different environment. So all the mechanisms for making money that I think we thought were existing at the time, which were really in their last vestiges, it was just kind of wisps of that, now even that's gone. And in my world now, in classical music, you know, you see such a despondency over streaming revenues, over, you know, these are our folks who traditionally were used to a much different type of environment and atmosphere. And when they realize that making a recording with a symphony orchestra is part of a larger promotional picture, as opposed to being the end all be all of the process. I mean, that's hard to come to terms with when you've lived your whole life believing that, you know, these truths are to be held self-evident, but they're not. And you see it across the board. But that's why it's cool to talk to you because, I mean, you're going out to see concerts, man. I mean, like not a lot of people do that anymore. It's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you touched on something that is interesting because when I first came in contact with you, that was around the time of American Standard. And I remember you were touring. Like, I think you even came out this way at some point. Yeah. And that was a different time. That was a time when you could still get in a van and maybe do 6 weeks if you had the dedication and the routing to do it.
Exactly. And we were reminiscing about this because we're in the studio, we're making a new record right now. And the funny thing about Dreadnought is that we have this history now of making demos and then completely fucking forgetting about them. And then finding them years and years and years later being like, oh, whoa, wait a minute. That's really good. So this is the third time that we have written a record and forgotten about it. And I would say the record's probably like 85% done. I mean, some rearrangement needs to be done, needs to be recorded. And you know, the way that we do stuff, we do it like Queen, right? So like when I say we've got a record written, it's the three of us on a two track recording. But when we go in the studio and do it, we blow the doors off. But I remember when we were in the studio a couple weeks back doing this one piece that we wrote 25 years ago and just like forgot about, we were laughing and reminiscing over when we were doing our touring. And we got out there, we play Lawrence, we get out to Boise, we do Colorado, we do Utah, we do every state in between. But, you know, I would have to print out maps that I downloaded from MapQuest on my dial-up internet and work out the routing, right? And figure out, well, where is there a Days Inn that we can get for $49 without having to pay extra for the rollaway so we can get to the gig on Monday night from the gig on Sunday night where we weren't getting paid jack shit. So yeah, it was possible to do that, and I think that there were just more places to do it. There were more outlets, there were more venues. So it's a completely different ballgame. But man, I remember, you know, so clearly being at a hotel. It was in, I think we were in Illinois. I can't remember exactly where we were, but I remember the experience. And it was me on the dial-up internet at the hotel, just working on booking emails, working on promo, setting up interviews, doing all this stuff. And I went to get a Coca-Cola in the lobby, and the guy's like, yeah, I hope you know that your internet bill is up above $650 right now. And I'm like, what? You know, it was the Wild West, and I don't think we didn't even realize it at the time, but we were laughing like crazy about this in the studio, just being like, do you remember that shit? What were we thinking?
So yeah. At some point, then you kind of have to pivot, right? Because live music, as you were saying, you know, kind of dries up and it becomes more difficult to be an independent band. So what did that look like? Like, you still want to be in the game, you still want to make money, you still want to create, and you still want to create with the guys that you're with. So what do you do?
Well, look, I think what we did, well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I remember playing a gig where we had a guy watch us totally transfixed, you know, because with us live, it's like, it really is like acrobatics. And the shit that we do, and we're even wilder now because we have, our powers are much stronger. But I remember back then, this guy watching us, and he was just transfixed. And he came up to us afterwards. He's like, "You guys are amazing. It sounds fantastic." I mean, wow, what a gig. My God. We're like, "Oh, thanks. He's like, "So do you guys want to succeed at doing this? Like, you want to make a living in the music industry?" And we're like, "Yeah, of course." He goes, "Well, then why the fuck are you playing what you're playing?" You know, and it was a really good question, which is, you know, if you want to succeed, you probably shouldn't do what we tried to do, unless you're lucky enough to find that rabid following of people who are completely psychotic, which I find often has less to do with music and more to do with the culture, right? It has very little to do with the music itself and more to do with what the experience around consuming the music is, what the community is, which you see in a lot of subgenres. But at that point, you know, yeah, we had to say, well, what are we going to do? And in my case, you know, I was always interested in custom audio composition. I was always interested in TV theme songs. Like, Mike Post is one of my favorite composers. And when I was at school, I really seriously wanted to, or was considering trying to figure out how to get into film scoring and even film editing. And so I was always interested in that side of stuff. So that's where I began to put some time and energy and attention. So in addition to playing gigs and being the booking agent and doing all that, I was also writing a lot of music for independent films, ad agencies, just small jobs, nothing crazy and huge, but, you know, a few fun things here and there. So it was a way to, number one, get my chops up, number two, get some cash flowing and all the rest. And I think, you know, when Dreadnought gave up its profit motives, I would tell you that I think that the art got infinitely better. And I think the stuff that we've done since then is everything that we do, the next thing that we do is always the best thing that we've ever done, because we really don't give a shit. It doesn't mean anything. And I was having this conversation with Dan Brown the other day, the guy that wrote The Da Vinci Code, because I'm his music producer. We've been working together for years and years. We travel together. We do a shitload of work together. And, I, you know, it's wonderful because either you have no success and you don't give a shit, or you have so much success and you don't give a shit, right? Dan sold like 300 million books. He doesn't give a shit about anything. He's like, "I'm just going to write the book I want to write now." And there is something wonderfully liberating about that creatively. And then from that point on, honestly, it was just bit by bit for me kind of transforming being a producer, which I was for Dreadnought and other bands and for all these kind of custom audio jobs like I described before, into being a producer of classical musicians and ensembles, and realizing, oh, wait a minute, it's the same thing, just slightly different. And so, yeah, so that's how that all kind of happened. It was 20 years ago that I made that pivot into classical professionally. And just kind of jumped in head first. And then it was 17 years ago when I started Parma. And I said, this is what I want to do, and this is how I'm going to do it. And I did it. And kind of wake up, and it's all these years later. And I really do wonder how I kind of wonder how it all happened. But yeah, that's the story.
So when you entered that world, could you, like, read a score, all of that stuff?
Yeah, I could. But yeah. It took me a number of years to get there. You know, Justin went to Berkeley, so he's very, very well educated, really musically just, you know, he's unimpeachable and a wonderful guitar player and a wonderful musician. But me, I mean, I remember when I started to play, my teacher was just like, you know, this notation thing, it's harder for you than actually playing. He's like, you can play by ear. You've got a great ear. You can play. He's like, focus on that and you'll come around. So the thing that the flip that happened with me was, I think most people sit down in front of music and they play it by looking at what the notes are, and then they try and make it sound like they think it should sound. Whereas in my case, I already knew what it sounded like, so it was just a matter of attaching, oh, that's what this looks like, as opposed to what should this sound like. Completely different process, right? And it's like a complete reversal of how most people learn it. And so by the time I really got into the classical stuff, I had taught myself basically everything that I needed to know to be able to do it. Now, am I the kind of guy that can sit down at a piano with an orchestral score and automatically transpose everything and play it? No, there's like, you know, 100 people in the world that can do that. But can I get a great recording of a piece that, you know, has, I have in front of me on the stand. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You purchased the label, is that correct?
No. I founded the company. So I started the thing from scratch.
Okay.
No investment, no money from home, no nothing. And I founded it in May of 2008. So literally like the worst time anyone could start a fucking business was when I decided to do this. But I had been running a classical label out of Boston for 3 years at that point. So that was kind of my incubator.
Okay.
And so from that point on, I started the Parma. I started the other labels that were at that point underneath our umbrella. And then I ended up acquiring a bunch of other labels. I acquired the label that I was running out of Boston. I acquired a couple more. We just acquired another one last year. I'm in talks with two others right now. I probably will have a deal done in the next couple months, I would imagine. So it's been both like, you know, build it and then kind of acquire and build out from there as well. But we have, I think we're somewhere in the mid-30s in terms of full-time employees. And we go from Los Angeles to Prague every time zone in between. And we just opened up a studio in Prague that we're doing recordings at today, actually, which is, Jed, it's fun for me, man. I get to sit at home with my cats and my wife. And, I mean, I'm working my ass off, don't get me wrong. But at least the recording sessions are happening and I don't have to be there. So it's a nice step.
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of questions emerge there. Number one.
Yeah.
You mentioned 2008, you know, starting a business, but anymore, you know, who starts a label? And then, I mean, come on, in the world of classical, I mean, that's beneath jazz, right, in terms of numbers.
Exactly, yeah. you know, yeah. Well, I was reading something. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the numbers are really close to this, so forgive me if I'm not perfect, but as of like 2023, I think it was, 24, the entirety of the market share for classical and jazz was, I think, 3.6%, and Taylor Swift's market share alone was 4.1%.
Hmm.
I mean, when you stop and think about what that means, it's like, holy shit. On the other hand, I think one of the reasons why I was really attracted to starting a company in this sector is because I could affect change. I could make a difference. And that's a big part of why I did it was, you know, kind of screaming into the void in rock and roll or jam band or metal or whatever at that point in the early 2000s. And, you know, Dreadnought, we'd done the very best we could and worked our asses off. But from an economic standpoint, it was like, well, wait a minute, who am I competing against? It's so much competition. Whereas in classical, when I took a look at it, I said, oh, okay, so this entire environment is backwards. It's being run by a bunch of idiots. And there's actually some good work that can be done here. So the kind of conceit that I had was if I could create a major label system, a closed circuit with no third parties or, you know, to the greatest extent possible, no vendors, if I could build that, then I could control, you know, the means of production. I could control the distribution. I could control the marketing, the, you know, the leveraging of the intellectual property, all of it. So that's kind of what is interesting is we handle the entire life cycle of all of it. Now, if we, there's a plus and a minus to that. Number one, it makes it very, very hard to compete with us because we can do, and we do everything, and we do it at a very high level. The downside is that in each one of the silos of our work, whether it is, you know, speculative, or whether it is a charged service, as is the case with like our web development work or whatever, we have a lot of discrete competition. So it's both a blessing and a curse. But the diversification of the whole thing is part of the point was, you know, if you throw all your eggs in any one basket, that is a dangerous fucking thing to do, especially when you're running a record label. So I figured, all right, you know, if we can figure out a way to be able to generate revenue from all the kind of ancillary services that are necessary to make any record, in addition to making the record, well, then we can figure out a really interesting way forward. And that's basically what's happened because now we've got in our catalog, we have over 3,000 albums. And, you know, that works for itself to a degree. But we also have to make sure that we're doing all the promo, all the marketing, all of it. And, you know, we do all the graphic design. We do the web development. We do the recording. We do everything. And then we do various bits of it, you know, individually. Like, for example, we handle Dan Brown's website. DanBrown.com is designed and managed by us. So even though it's a little bit out of market, you know, we've basically been tailoring what we do to help the creative sector, and not just classical and jazz, but but a little bit wider than that. And I think that's one area where we're going to see some growth is like, I mean, you know this as well as I do, but the barriers between genres and concepts, it's all gone to shit. It doesn't matter anymore, right? Like, it's all music, man. And I think that's just going to continue onward and onward and onward, especially as people like Snoop Dogg keep coming out and saying, yeah, I want to get involved in classical music. So,
yeah.
It's an interesting sector that we're in for sure.
Well, and that's the thing. I think that this is a time where, so for instance, last year, Wichita Symphony did a world premiere with a composer, Tim Hink. And Tim's whole idea as a composer is that he wants to be collaborative with orchestras. His idea is that if classical music's going to survive, it has to come out of the ivory tower. And it has to attract people who are not just there for Brahms and so forth. And I think this label is also doing this. This is not the 15th repackaging of the Mozart Requiem Mass and so forth.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, I wrote a blog post, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so, it's still up there somewhere, about, like, imagine if you lived in a world where there were 15 versions of Steely Dan's, you know, Royal Scam that came out every year, each with a very slight variation in tempo and mix.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absurd, but that's exactly what happens in classical. I think in the year that I wrote that, there was something along the lines of 40 recordings of Beethoven's, I think it was the Third Symphony that came out. 40? I mean, who the fuck needs that? Like, it's just, and you know, I had a really interesting experience I had working with this one string quartet, and they're wonderful. They're out of Houston, Rice University, Shepherd School, which is one of the top schools in the country. And so they came to me and they said, you know, friend of a friend, and they came to my office when I had an office, which we're now all virtual, but they said, Mr. Lord, we want to make our first debut album, our first record, and we're just, you know, arguing and debating over what we want to do for repertoire. And I said, what are you guys considering? And he said, well, we've got it down to either the Beethovens or the Bartoks, which are like literally the most obvious things any string quartet could do. So I stood up, I pointed my finger, I said, get the fuck out of my office. And like, I mean, it was a joke, but they were scared shitless for a second. And actually, you should listen to the record that ended up happening because of that conversation. It's by a group called the Axiom Quartet. Name of the album is Axioms. We spent like 6 months in pre-production thinking about, well, what do you want to say? What are you trying to do? What's the purpose? Like, I mean, if someone comes to me and says, I want to make a record and they can't tell me why, I won't work with them. I won't do it. Like, I'm not going to do it. Like, what's the functionality and the purpose? So we came up with this whole concept of like the concept of universal truths, right? Axioms. I mean, it's the whole concept. And so the fifth Beatle in the band is the husband of the cellist, who's my dear friend. And he basically arranged all the material for the string quartet. So it's stuff like, you know, traditional classical rep like Monteverdi, Charles Ives, it's Fleetwood Mac, it's Bob Dylan. And then my buddy, his husband, wrote interstitial material for all the tracks. So basically in between each one of the tracks is stuff that connects all these tracks. And this is not normally how people make classical music. This is what the reason why I'm doing this is because I want to apply that prog rock viewpoint, that pop viewpoint, the rock and roll way, the late 60s, 70s way of doing it to this kind of antiquated system. And by the way, Tim's concept, Wichita is a great group. And I think that's exactly right. I think that orchestras are actually looking to engage with people who are active in the process as opposed to the old dead white guy.
Yep.
I think it's the way it's happening, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think the other thing that I've seen with the stuff that you've put out, there's also in the classical world where there's the kind of like sexification of classical music, where it's like, you know what I'm talking about? It's like this.
Yeah, sure.
And that doesn't seem to be part of your game plan.
No. I would much rather embrace humor, which we do. Like we've got some fucking artwork that is just hysterical. We've got some music that is hysterical. You know me, like, you've listened to Dreadnought's music, you realize that the playfulness is part of the point. But that is so clearly where so many of the major labels are now driving. You take a look at Yuja Wong. I just saw this one harpist the other day, and her album cover, it was like, I thought I was looking at a Penthouse cover, if one could even find a Penthouse anymore in any shop. But that's exactly what's happening is as the returns are diminishing, they're saying, well, we want to compete. But their version of that is what you just described, as opposed to what I described from a production process. So I think that's absolutely what's happening is the sexification of classical music. I like that an awful lot. You should write an article about that.
Okay.
That's a good one.
You got it. So what did you have in your training that made you run, allowed you to run a business efficiently with all these employees and umbrella companies and so forth?
Absolutely nothing. I have no formal training in music, and I have no formal training in business. I am an English major. I read books. I'm lucky that my dad was one of, like, the first kind of modern businessmen, I think, out there. When I was growing up, my friends' fathers were all 40 years at the same company. They got the gold watch at the retirement party, and then that was that. My dad had a new gig every 3 years. He was starting his own company. He was, running the sales department of that company. He was CEO of that company, whatever. So I just watched him, and he taught me. He taught me basically everything I know about business. Although he has no experience, never at all, in the music world at all, except through me. So I really didn't have any formal training, didn't have any aspect of that at all. But I think, were I a violin player or were I a lead vocalist, this would be a very different thing, and it might not have worked. I think the fact that I was a bass player who wanted to play like Entwistle, who was constantly getting into arguments with people because he said, turn down the treble and don't be so loud, start playing on the one and the three or whatever. Like, it's that mentality, I think, that allowed me to kind of do this. And then the biggest challenge I had was being an only child and being sure that my way is always the right way, and that if you want to get something done right, you got to do it yourself. That has taken me, it took me a long time to shed that bullshit, but I absolutely have, and I've embraced it. I love it. I love the fact that I'm, although I've done everything in the company, and I've done everything that I've asked someone else to do, everything. Although that's the case, I'm no longer the best in my own company at any one of those things, except running the company. And I think that that's cool. And I guess the way I would say it to relate it back to The Who is, I remember the story about Keith Moon being in the studio when they're recording Who Are You? And they were doing Music Must Change, which is in 6/8, and he couldn't do it. He fucking couldn't play in 6/8. He couldn't play the cut. And he threw his drumsticks down on the ground. He said, I'm still the best Keith Moon-style drummer in the world.
Right.
And I feel that way about, I'm still the best Bob Ward-style bass player in the world. I'm still the best Bob Ward-style CEO in the world. And I'd rather be that than anything else. It has been really interesting to just give up the ghost of that I need to be in control over everything all the time, and to realize that it's just impossible, especially when you get 3 dozen people that you're managing, which is, by any objective measure, not a big company, but by the music business definition, it's substantial. And especially in classical music, when you look at Deutsche Grammophon, if I'm not mistaken, Deutsche Grammophon has under 10 full-time employees worldwide.
Wow.
And it's shocking when you stop and think about that. It's been an interesting run. If you saw a picture of me, if you saw me in person and I told you I was 48 years old, you would probably say more like 88, right? I mean, I've lived a lot of lives at this point. So.
Well, there's earlier you mentioned this thing about your friend's son who was like selling shoes, right, online.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I had this conversation last night with a student. She is, she's doing her student teaching with elementary school kids, and they're all saying, oh, I want to be a YouTuber. And she's like, oh, like that'll happen. And I said, you know what? You should probably take those kids and show them the ropes of how to be a YouTuber, because some of them are going to be successful, and they're going to be successful because they're going to figure out that that's what they really want. And others are going to figure out it isn't it for me. I like the idea of it, but it's just not my game.
I could not agree more. I think And the thing that, so for example, the thing from a management perspective that I had to let go is I would have a new employee come up to me and say, oh, Bob, I have this great idea. I want to try this, like this marketing technique or this thing or whatever. 9 times out of 10, maybe even more, I had already done it and it had failed. And I tried to do it again and it also failed. And then I tried to do it again and it also failed. Now here I have a young staffer full of piss and vinegar coming at me with this great idea that they have. And I finally learned you have to let them do it. Because maybe they can do it when you couldn't do it, but also if it's going to fail, then they have to fail at it so they understand, as opposed to me telling them why it's going to fail. And that costs money. It takes time. It's stress. But in the end, it's the right thing for the employee. And I think in the same way that you just described with the student, it's like, well, don't prejudge their circumstance because you don't know. I mean, we have no idea. Would you have ever expected that we would be in the situation that we're in with AI right now, like 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Of course not. So you just don't know the way things are going to go. And that's good advice for your colleague.
Well, I mean, and it just strikes me that sounds kind of like, you know, what you've done, which is like, hey, if I want to stay in the game of music, I know at some point I'm going to have to pivot. And here's an opportunity. Here's something here's a hole that needs to be filled. I'm going to be the person that does it.
Definitely. I mean, my pop taught me, he said, you never want to be the last buggy whip salesman. Right? I mean, now I've argued at that point with him a few times. I'm like, actually, Dad, you know, if there's only one buggy whip salesman and there's only one place to get the buggy whips, okay, fine. But he's right. And like, you know, I mean, even this morning, I spent an hour on a call with one of my staffers just speaking specifically about this issue, about diversification in this kind of subset of the business. And look, you know, just for example, what we see now is that there are a lot of younger performers who are getting out of college, who are very high level, coming out of the best universities in the country. But guess what? There's tens of thousands of other kids at a very high level coming out of the best universities in the country. So how do you differentiate yourself? And so what we've seen is there's an increasing demand for audiovisual services to create, you know, quote unquote, demo reels for them to pitch themselves to symphony orchestras for jobs or for gigs or whatever. You know, and it's a subset of a subset of a subset where you say, okay, my core competence is creating outstanding audiovisual content, releasing it, distributing, marketing it, and selling it. Well, what if we only do a portion of that and we focus specifically on an at-need sector of the market? And, you know, that kind of conversation happens literally every single day at the company, across the whole company. And so that's the thing that makes me feel good, is like it definitely is the snake that's constantly shedding its own skin. And I think the minute you stop doing that, I think you're fucked. And how many bands have you heard that have continued to make the same record over and over and over again now? Like, I don't know. I think once you get in that rut, I think you gotta stop and say, well, what am I doing and why am I doing it?
Well, I'll kind of close out on this. Now, if I'm not mistaken, and my research is correct, next year would be 30 years for Dreadnought together?
That is correct.
Okay. And
it's alarming.
If I'm not mistaken, it's there's been one lineup shift in that entire time.
I think you could call it two. But really one major one was when we started the band, and so I transferred down to UNH from UVM. My buddy Ed that I told you about before, Ed Jurdy, he went to UNH, I went to UVM, and we had a wonderful career together in high school. We were super popular as a band, and just, you know, we were successful. And but figured we'd go our separate ways and do our separate thing. So we did. And 2 years into college, I mean, we'd see each other every time. We'd call each other all the time. He'd visit me, I'd visit him. But about 2 years in, I gave him a ring, and I'm just like, hey, man, how's it going for you down there with the music? He said, shitty. And he said, how's it going for you? I said, shitty. I said, well, what if I transferred down there? Would you want to get it going again? And he said, sure. And then that's what ended up becoming Dreadnought. He left the band early in the career. We started playing as a four or five piece. Then we added Justin, and we kind of merged Justin's band and Dreadnought. And then all the other guys kind of fell to the side, except for me and Justin and Rick. And that was in 99, 2000, in that ballpark, 99, I think. So that's been the core of the whole group since. And we had about a 2 year span where Rick left the band. He was tired of playing and, you know, had a lot of shit going on. And we had another drummer by the name of Tim Haney. And then Tim, kind of Rick wanted to come back and Tim was going to do other shit. And so we said, okay, fine. And then that was in, I think, 05, 06. So yeah, it's the last 20 years have been uninterrupted, but basically me and Rick have been playing together for 30 years and me and Rick and Justin for 26 years.
Wow, incredible. So yeah. What do you attribute that to? You're just all equally as adventurous in terms of the music?
You know, I can't recall a single argument. I can't recall an actual argument over over the music itself. And I'll tell you, so, like, for example, we were in the studio the other day. We're doing the song, the one I was telling you about. It's called The Bastard, The Bastard's theme from The Bastard. So it's like a fake TV theme song almost. And so we're on the fourth overdub of Nose Flutes. And Justin turns to me with his hand on his chin, looking very contemplative. He goes, "Bob, I don't know about this." I looked at him and said, "Justin, you're like 25 years too fucking late, dude. Like, I mean, this is, we're way past that at this point." But it's really funny. Like, you know, when we're in the studio, nobody's arguing. Nobody's arguing about this is bad, this is terrible, that's not right. It's absolutely, we're all going in one direction. And I think, like, a lot of times when you have groups where there's individual songwriting credits, which we don't do, it's all group written and, you know, all the rest. Or there's some fucking ego where there's some lead singer or this or that or whatever. You know, these things, they stratify in certain kinds of bands. But with us, it really is three equal viewpoints. And I think that's just highly, highly, highly unusual. And I also think that we work very quickly. We know immediately what works and what doesn't work. We choose not to belabor it. We don't kvetch over stuff that's unimportant. And I think we're very supportive of each other in terms of push it, go as crazy as you possibly can, and then maybe dial it back by like 5% if we all agree on it. And that's it. I think that's been the magic of the whole thing.
You've been listening to a conversation with Bob Lord of the band Dreadnought and CEO of Parma Recordings. You can learn more about Bob Lord at boblordmusic.com and more about the band Dreadnought at dreadnoughtrock.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. We do welcome your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And you can learn more about this podcast, including checking out past episodes at the KMUW website, kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.